So I've got to ask, this movie like blew me away. I was like, where is this going? Where did this come from? Where did this story kind of spark from?
Well, I'll give you the long version because I am Mr. Candor, and you can whittle it down as much as you want. This is my seventh feature, and about 3 years ago, I knew I had the ability to raise the same amount of money to make my seventh feature as it cost to make my sixth feature. So I said, okay, just let her rip, you know. And I came up with a script I fell in love with that I wrote called Abigail's Surrender, and it was a period piece set in 1974, mostly to be set outside of Dallas, Texas, with a little in Tennessee, a little in Pennsylvania, and even less, a smidgen in New York. And I gave it to my producer. I said, okay, let's budget it formally, officially. And he came up with a budget that was twice as much as I could ever raise for it. And I got summarily depressed and decided, obviously, I'm never going to make another movie. And that mindset lasted for about a week. And I said to myself, no, of course you're going to make more movies, but it's got to be set, and it's got to shoot in New York, where I can enjoy the same rather generous tax credit from the state that I was able to obtain for my last film, Mad Women. And I've got to be able to, confine the shooting area, the locations, to, generally the New York City area. At that time, I realized in the last couple of years, as a distributor, I had released three films. Two were Israeli. One was an independent American Jewish-themed comedy. And they were all either mediocre or bad films. And they all made money. And I said, I grew up in a conservative Jewish family. I'm Jewish. Why don't I set my sights on doing something that was good, exciting, unique, original, and hopefully provocative? And I said, right at that time, my nephew, who's now 30 or 31 years old, had just gotten married. And of course, I was at the wedding. Of course, I know this guy his whole life. And he grew up in a conservative Jewish family. He's my sister's son. And about right after college, he became a modern Orthodox Jew, something I knew absolutely nothing about. And he didn't believe in God, but he firmly believed in the community of modern Orthodoxy. And he had just married a girl, another modern Orthodox Jew, who 6 months earlier had been Catholic. And she had always been fascinated by and luxuriated in her friends' Jewish celebrations and festivals and holidays. And once she met and began dating, my nephew said, well, I'm going to convert. And that was not conditional on their marriage. It was not conditional on anything. It was something she had a passion for almost her whole life. And she very much believed in God. And so I took them out to dinner with a tape recorder, and for 2.5 hours, I just asked them about their lives and their philosophies and, their relationship. And I said, wow, these two characters, these two people are a great basis, are two great characters for a film. I said, now I needed a story and a drama around that. And my films, more often than not, they've always been love stories, they've been relationship dramas, and they've often been they're almost always about strong female characters, and almost always that about multiple generations of families. But I've never endeavored to do something more than three generations. Well, I realized if I went back four generations, I'm at the Holocaust. Mm. And as we all know, the Holocaust has proven a very potent backdrop to wildly successful movies, wildly unsuccessful movies. And two of my top 20 films of all time deal with the Holocaust, one being Schindler's List and one being Night and Fog. But that wasn't enough for me. I said, well, everybody's doing stories. A lot of people are doing show-us type stories. survivor type stories, but I wanted to come up with something that nobody has ever either braved to tell or, you know, I wanted to tell a story about a Holocaust survivor unlike any that had ever been told before. And that's when I came up with the character of Claire, who would be the matriarch of a four-generation family, the most beloved member of the family, and have her, you know, due to circumstances beyond her own control, make what turns out to be a deathbed confession, which completely, obviously, puts the whole family in crisis, on a countdown clock. You know, how, and then everything else organically came from that. The monologue, Claire's confession at the beach, her monologue, was maybe, it flowed out of me so fast. You know, I had done some, I had done some research, because I didn't get an A in, you know, American history or World War II history or Western European history. And I decided at some point to imbue, to infuse the script with factual characters. And I needed that in order to make vivid and believable Claire's remarkable story. And I needed a timeline that worked. And so I decided I was going to give her, I was going to put somebody in her life who does exactly as she says they did, which is somebody who tried to save her mother's life at childbirth, who's literally saved her life, who then, you know, from afar and sometimes up close, nurtured her, obeyed or maintained, you know, was true to a deathbed promise that he would see that she was being brought up properly and well and healthy, and brings music into her life, music being the second leitmotif of this movie, and puts her in nursing school, as she says, at the age of 14, unheard of, and ultimately, and who went to, and was studying to be a gynecologist, because he had this, you know, this abiding interest in artificial insemination, in sterilization, in infertile women, and who ultimately said, I'm being shipped off to work in Poland, and I want you to come and be my nurse. And to be able to tell this incredible half-century-long story where, you know, and it was a commoner story. That's the thing. It's like, think for a second. In Germany, the commoner, around the time, you know, once the Weimar Republic ended and the Nazi Party took over and rose to power, there was no television. There was barely radio, and most of what they got on the radio was pure propaganda. And she's a little girl and then a little teenager. What does she know about, you know, what's really going on in the war, or what's really going on, you know, in the mind of people like Joseph Mengele? And so I needed a Joseph Mengele. There were many Joseph Mengeles during the Holocaust, and we don't know the rest of them, but there were a lot of them. And it didn't have to be Auschwitz. I started doing research, and the one that I came up with rather quickly happened to be assigned to Auschwitz, and that was Karl Klauberg. So once I was able to fold, and he worked with this guy named Horst Schumann. And once I was able to, timeline-wise and drama, in terms of the dramaturgy of this piece, fold him in, everything, that monologue came so easy, it flowed so easily. And I had done research about Germany just before the turn of the century. And I had done a little bit of research on Germany. I had to make all the details of her mother's life not just vivid, but real. And then the other thing I neglected to say is that I realized when I came up with the idea of creating a character who was involved stunningly with concentration camp and the Holocaust, was that we were approaching the centennial not of the Holocaust, but of the Nazis' rise to power.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of a different story to tell. And what does it mean to the commoner? And Claire was a commoner. Claire was an innocent bystander who became a not so innocent bystander by dint of circumstance. Who became a willing participant in one of the most horrific genocides of mankind. So, and then it's like if you put yourself in her exact position. I'm not trying to induce sympathy or empathy from her family or from the viewer, but I do want you to have to answer that question. What would you do? What would you have done? And I defy anybody, if they're being honest, to say they wouldn't have gone to Auschwitz too. And so I came up with this idea about a story that had never been told before. And it's fiction. And 2 months after I wrote the script, a page one story on the New York Times, on the front page of the New York Times, with the headline, "My Grandfather Was a Nazi." Same story, gender reversed. And I can send you that link. And then when we were in post-production, New York Times front page story, man, it's always a man. A man was discovered in Queens, New York, who had been living as a Jew and who was a Nazi during the Holocaust and had been extra. They had been discovered, found, hunted down, and at the age of 90s, or I think late 80s, I can't remember off the top of my head, was being extradited to Germany for trial. And a month ago, the front page of the Chicago Tribune, same story. Although that one was not the same story, but it was about a woman, present-day woman, who just discovered that her grandmother, not great-grandmother, that her grandmother had been a Nazi involved. But she lives, she knew her, she stayed in Europe. She remained in Europe. And this is front page of the Chicago Tribune 4 or 6 weeks ago. And so this thing that I thought was going to be this fantastical story, it turns out it's all too common. And never, to the best of my knowledge, been explored in a dramatic film or stage or book or television before, even on Netflix.
I love that last bit.
I'm sorry, that's an awfully long answer to your question.
No, but it does sum up so well, but doesn't give, I think, a lot of the emotional elements of the film that people can watch. I was blown away by the reactions, and you talk about passing judgment. Like, how could you brought up that, how could anyone not do what Claire did? And I was more fascinated with the way each character has their own rationale of what should happen to her. Whether it's, AJ's character, the grandson deciding, she needs to go to The Hague, she needs to be on trial, and each person has their own viewpoint. How much fun was it giving each character a different way of looking at Claire's, revelation about who she was? I mean, it must have been exciting to go down each character's way of handling it.
It was exciting. It was pivotal. It was essential that each of the surviving members of the family reacted in different ways, including the newest member of the family. And that's kind of a cliche, but it's true, which is that the convert to Judaism becomes the most Jewish person in the family. And, of course, she's the one we're not exactly sure. We never exactly know right off the bat she's going to take Claire to Oregon out of a sense of compassion, it seems, to help her end her life with dignity, or with as much dignity as can be mustered for a woman who has just said what she said. Josh, of course, takes it the most personally, because because he converts to modern Orthodox Judaism 7, 8, 9 years ago, and suddenly he realizes the ultimate irony, he's not even Jewish, and he sets the line, "I'm not even Jewish," and he recently marries a woman who is the most Jewish person in their family, who 6 months ago was Catholic. And Melody when she discovers the truth about not just Claire, but her parents, about the fact that her parents actually knew all along and didn't tell her, she responds with abject fury at her dead parents, who clearly she goes to visit at their cemetery regularly, and always takes a tape gun and two pictures, so she's not just speaking to a slab of marble. And Harry, you know, this dark graphic novelist, decides he's going to desperately try to keep this woman alive to sap, you know, to withdraw, to get every last bit of sap from her as fodder for his new graphic novel called The Last. And he says he's doing it for the benefit of his children, you know, and his daughter-in-law. It was terrific. That's how I came up with a different personality for each character. And I don't think anybody gets short shrift, not even Melody. She has her own arc. And of course, Harry, the character of Harry, played by Reed Birney, you know, I gave him this massive graphic novel theme, and the biggest laugh line in the movie when he tells that remarkable anecdotal internet story he found about who Angela Merkel's parents really were. And this very short but vulnerable piece later in the film. And Reed Birney is remarkable. I mean, you know, he's given this chunky 10-minute scene where he's anchoring the scene, and it's only, you watch him, it's almost like he says, okay, just say action, turns the key, and you're watching a master at work. Did that kind of answer your question?
No, it definitely did. You know, I was fascinated, Jeff, by the fact that I love the look of the film. I love how the kind of shot choices y'all went with, and how close we get to each actor and how many people are in the frame. But I was looking back trying to figure out, you know, because compared to like Mad Women or Molly's Theory of Relativity, or, you know, all the way back, like, you know, how many of your DPs or have y'all kept this, you know, have you kept the same vision? And I realized Ruben is the only one that's been on a few of your movies. You've always had a new DP for your films.
Yeah.
What makes you want to go for a different person? Is it to help you look at it differently, or how does that help you?
Honestly, I'm a victim of circumstance. I managed to find relatively underutilized or diamonds in the rough, underutilized talented DPs or diamonds in the rough. They're almost always young, and sometimes this is their first opportunity to shoot a feature, and they're so good that they have to make a living, and I can no longer afford them. That's the simple truth. In the past, because of some graphic material in my film, I have definitely been on the prowl for great female DPs. In fact, except for Ruben and Erlander on this film. Of course, this film doesn't have, you know, intimate scenes or graphic nudity or anything like that, so that was not an issue. Except for the two of them, all my other DPs were female. And I'm very proud of the fact that they have gone on to join the union and make themselves unaffordable to me. So that's really the honest answer to your question. And in the case of Ruben working twice, I have to say, he really connived his way into a second go with me. The first time we worked together was my first digital filming experience, which was Once More with Feeling, which I didn't even write. And he enjoyed working with me so much. He did want to work with me again, but especially when he discovered that my next film, which was 1230, I was going back to shoot on film again. And he was, I think all DPs are thrilled now, in this day and age, about the opportunity to work on film. So he said, I own a 5x16 camera, let's work together again, I'll donate the camera for free. Which of course helped. You know, but he did a good digital job, and I was new to digital, and we used primitive digital equipment on that film, on Once More with Feeling. And that's why he came back, because he did a good job, and because he was going to give us his camera. And he wanted to do, he had a great passion for wanting to do it because it was an opportunity to shoot a feature on film, which unfortunately is the last time I was able to shoot a feature on film so far, only because the cost is significantly higher. But I love shooting on film.
Well,
if I had the money, I'd do it on my next film.
Well, I definitely have loved the different aesthetics you've had over the years with your DPs, and I hope you keep having this Midas touch, because, yeah, you're making people's careers. It's lovely.
Yeah, I mean, and Lord knows, I love, I am a loyalist. I mean, obviously from Reed Birney and Rebecca Shaw, you know, you can see that. But that extends to the crew, too. I had the same costume designer who I first worked with me on Flannel Pajamas. She worked on three of my films, and she was going to work on another one, but she had committed to another film. I've tried to stay with the same script the two that I fell in love with, script supervisors, but one became an editor right after it and began editing TV series and making a fortune. The other one was Brazilian and went back home. You know, I try. When I find quality key crew members, I dance a jig to get them back. With actors, it's a little bit easier because, you know, when you have a cinematographer, that person is really committed, even though he might not be getting paid for this extent of this period of time. It kind of commits to you for 6 to 9 months. Actors don't do that. You know, they'll work on 4, 5, 6, 7, 10 movies a year. And if you tell them, I need you for 2 weeks, 3 weeks, they come back. Well, of course, I wish I had the luxury of working for 2, 3, 6 weeks with these people. One of the other reasons they come back to me is because, that's the other thing. I don't like to advertise this necessarily. We just had a casting crew screening of the last evening, and which, of course, becomes a teary-eyed reunion. And I said to them in my emotional opening speech before the movie, there is not another crew in this city. There's not another cast in this city. And I do think it was my best cast, top to bottom. Because we worked with 24 people. A lot of them are day players. But even though, I mean, I had a great casting director. But I said to them, there's not another crew, there's not another cast in this city who could have made this movie in 12 and a half days. It should have been impossible. And you people made it possible. You know, I don't want to shoot a movie in 12 and a half days. I actually like about 24 days. But I know I can do it because I've done it before. And I hope that people, you know, I'm very proud, you know, superbly proud of the result. And cross my fingers, I mean, the early reviews have borne that out. You know, I'm not going to bat 1,000 ever. But I'm too in your face with the kind of stories I tell. It's been a fever dream so far.